Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for November 22nd, 2015. I'm your host, David McLaughlin, on the road again. There used to be this thing called On the Road with Dutch Mantel when I used to be growing up watching wrestling. I feel like that because I'm not at my home base for 2 weeks in a row. But luckily, I've got Tim Shiflett running the board. Welcome, Tim.
Good evening, sir.
And Catherine Smith, she's in front of a computer, too. Welcome, Catherine.
Well, I'm in front of an iPad, and greetings from snowy Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Oh, wow. So
wow.
She's on the road, but she's at least got an iPad, which is essentially a computer. You got access to info, which is huge. So what you doing? Is it Thanksgiving or something else in Ann Arbor?
Well, I'm visiting with some friends, and I'll be spending Thanksgiving actually in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So I'm touring the state, you might say.
Just the lower peninsula, though, right?
Just the lower peninsula, yes. Actually, just the lower half of the lower peninsula.
The lower quarter, we'll say. I don't know if that's a Michigan term, but we'll go with it. Well, tonight we're real excited. Some of y'all may have already read on Peach Pundit, or, of course, if you're seeing our show page, Charlie Harper of Peach Pundit is going to be our special guest here in probably about 9 minutes. And he'll talk to us about all things on the Republican side of the aisle, which it's always good to kind of have somebody to give us a little different perspective. But Charlie's actually fits the Fox News slogan, fair and balanced, probably better than they do. So it's good to have Charlie on here in a little while. But until then, we're going to talk about maybe one of the most surprising races in recent years. I think if you would have said a year ago, probably even 6 months ago, that John Bel Edwards would win the race for governor in Louisiana, nobody would have believed you. We talked about these political stock markets you can put money on. If you could have laid money somewhere in Britain or wherever on this race, you could have cleaned up. But John Bel Edwards won this thing. Tim, how do you think he did it?
Well, for starters, the polls were pretty much spot on here, unlike Kentucky. And I'd like to give a shout-out to our friend Tom Jensen and the folks at Public Policy Polling who had this thing nailed, among others. I guess Bitter was just so damaged a candidate that he couldn't overcome his own deficiencies. In the closing days, he even tried to change the subject and focus on the terrorist attacks in Paris, and that was not going to work against his opponent, who happened to be a West Point graduate. This is one time that the voters in the Deep South bucked a rather lengthy trend in one of these states and simply voted for the better person regardless of party. Here's a funny thing. Even Governor Jindal wouldn't say who he voted for. And that's basically what I think happened, that Bitter was just a terrible candidate, and, we know about his past and stuff, and I think that's pretty much what happened.
Yeah, I think John Bel Edwards got every persuadable voter and more voters that, nine times out of ten aren't persuadable. He was able to get them. I think I sent y'all that article about the fact that Bitter tried to use terrorism as closing argument. And, of course, the last time that Louisiana's been involved on the ground in a war was 1812, Andrew Jackson. So, therefore, I think the people saw through that while terrorism may be a major issue for them, maybe, the refugee situation, something they care about. This governor's race, that was not the pressing issue. That's more of a federal issue, and that dog wasn't going to hunt. Catherine, is this a roadmap that Democrats around the South, at least, or maybe even Western states, rural districts, can use? Or is this just David Vitter, deeply flawed candidate, and we have to hope and pray for more of these guys or gals around the South?
Well, I think a lot of it, I mean, I think the majority of this win can be put at the feet of David Vitter being a lousy candidate, and of John Bel Edwards and his supporters and the party and other people reminding everyone that he was a flawed candidate and reminding them of some of the, you know, some of his indiscretions, you might say. So I think that's a big part of it. But, you know, we can always look at these elections and see, and try to garner some wisdom and information from what seemed to work and, you know, what who we were able to persuade. And, you know, hopefully there'll be some post-election surveys and polls to see what it was that, you know, really tripped it in Edwards' favor. So I think, I mean, I think there's always something to learn, but I think a lot of it had to do with Vitter. And the fact that they were reminding people of it. I mean, it wasn't just that Vitter was flawed. It was also that, you know, everyone was being reminded of how flawed he was. And I think that is important.
Yeah, I think there's two lessons I see from it. One, you know, David Vitter won a race for federal office. He won re-election to the Senate. And I think a lot of these, you know, Republican-leaning conservative voters in the South, in federal races, it's going to be harder to get them. But if we can remind them that this is a state race, then you can maybe get them for governor, lieutenant governor, you know, education or commissioner, attorney general, whatever it may be. You can still say, look, separate federal from statewide offices. I've had people tell me that in 2000, and there obviously weren't enough of them, in 2014, they were going to vote for Jason Carter for governor. They weren't probably planning on voting for Michelle Nunn for Senate, but they thought what was going on in this case, education, was so dreadful on the Republican side of things that they were going to buck their natural trend to switch over. Now, that was probably just, unfortunately, a small sample in Georgia, but in Louisiana, they did, you know, make the, you know, difference, and they obviously didn't like David Vitter, flawed candidate. Lesson number two is you got to have somebody in place to win these races. And, of course, if they would have just, you know, if Louisiana Democrats would have recruited any old cardboard cutout or some deeply flawed candidate on the other side, we couldn't have done it, but they found this West Point graduate who was a state senator in John Bel Edwards that was the best candidate we could put forth, or one of the best, and we're going to have people take chances because he could have likely gone down in flames, but he was there, and now he's going to be governor for at least one term in Louisiana and hopefully do some good things for the state. Tim, I think I heard you break it in.
Yeah. I was going to add something to what you had said earlier about the terrorism thing. It just seemed that the voters toward the end of this thing were pretty much ignoring any attacks made by the Vitter camp, like trying to connect Edwards to the president, the National Party, saying he was weak on terrorism. I think it showed me that the voters had made up their minds already about this thing, and they made it up early. Edwards came out of the primary with a double-digit lead. It never wavered. He maintained that double-digit lead, and he won last night by about 12 points. This thing's been over for a while. I don't guess we knew it at the time, especially considering how badly the polls were off in Kentucky. But this time we knew it. This thing has been over for a while, hadn't it?
It has. Now, one thing I have not been able to see, because, of course, I've, like I've said, been running up and down the road, personal reasons, is did we win state House and state Senate seats underneath that. And if y'all see any data, let me know. If you hadn't, that's something we got to look for.
I haven't seen any. I haven't looked.
No, but I know that the state Republican Party chair was, you know, talking about, well, we've got the legislature. And, David, I'm going to break in here because I believe our guest is with us.
Well, and that's what we do. Welcome back to the Kudzu Vine for the umpteenth time. And, Charlie, for some reason, it always seems like we have you in the winter time. When it's dark and cold, welcome back from Peach Fund, it's Charlie Harper.
Well, you know, it's just like the heart of my good Republican self. So, you know, it is what it is. I don't have to stop on my account. I'm still keep talking about the Cajuns, you know. You've got to celebrate your victories when and where you can get them, no matter how few they are between. But, you know, just go ahead. It's okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and let's start off there, to be fair. And, by the way, Charlie said you're a little under the weather. I want you to know that you at 50% is better than most of us at 110%. So that's why we're not worried.
Yeah. We got 40 or 50 minutes to prove that otherwise. So I guess we'll get on.
Well, give us real quickly, we didn't plan on this, but since we segued into it, give us the Republican view of the Louisiana Senate race, because it is a pretty rare deal that a Democrat takes anything back in the South these days.
Yeah, I won't claim to have been the closest person to follow it, but I do have a few friends that I've watched their email traffic and social media on, and I think y'all are fairly close to what it is. Bitter was just frankly not a good candidate. He was very damaged goods. He was able to win re-election to the Senate. I honestly don't remember. I guess that was 6 years ago, or 4 years ago, rather, because I believe he's up next year. But, you know, he has very clear baggage that is all admitted, and there's a certain segment of the Republican base that's just not going to put up with that crap, to put it plainly, and they didn't. And part of it is Louisiana has a jungle primary, and I don't know how much y'all got into that, but, you know, that's where the top two candidates that come out of a race were Republicans and Democrats and Independents and any other party that might be able to make it on the ballot are all on the same ballot together, and the top two go forwards. There is no actual primary, and I have a feeling had there been a primary on the Republican side, there would have been a runoff between Bitter and one of the, I believe it was two other major Republican candidates that ran. Maybe he wouldn't have been the nominee. He might have been. The power of incumbency, and even though he's not technically an incumbent, he's running as a statewide elected, might have still overcome it, but the result would have ended up being the same. And, you know, for that, for running a bad candidate, the Democrats get a pickup.
Yes. Well, we'll see what he does with it, and if this, you know, translates anywhere else or changes Louisiana, which had been trending as hard Republican as any other state in the South. Well,
it's also a timing issue. There is a small problem of Louisiana, the economy there being part of the oil patch with oil revenues going down. They had a much tougher time on their budget this year than most other southern states, where most other southern states are seeing revenues going up. Louisiana was not, but their budget is very different than the one here in Georgia. I still don't quite understand their budget process, but a large part of their budget revenues are fixed year over year. There's very little discretionary budget that the Louisiana state legislature gets to set. And so Jindal's, not only did Bobby Jindal just drop out of the presidential race, his favorables in Louisiana are not very high right now because the actual economy of the state of Louisiana is not really matching most other southern states. And so you just have a little bit of an air of negativity and willingness thus to try something different, I think, down there.
Yeah, second most unpopular governor in the country. Only Kansas's Sam Brownback rates lower. And also, of course, David Vitter and Bobby Jindal don't get along. So it's almost like they were almost on opposite sides of some pseudo primary thing going on there. Well, we're going to talk to you about pretty much national and Georgia issues. So let's start national. And I'm going to get the first question, then we'll pass it to Catherine, then to Tim, and go from there and just kind of lay out this presidential race. It looked like Donald Trump was going to start slipping. Mr. Electricity Ben Carson was going to start rising in the polls. And then, of course, he's falling back. And Donald Trump's kind of have a little mini resurgence. And, of course, the other folks are kind of mixing in Rubio and Cruz up a little bit, Jeb Bush down. Give us the Republican view of this presidential race.
Well, I'll give you my Republican view. I won't even come close to speaking for the entire party. But I think Donald Trump is with us for a little while longer. He's an entirely a media creation, from being a reality TV guy to even before that, probably a self-promoter that would have made P.T. Barnum jealous. And so he's got name ID, and then he's willing to say get him on any newscast at any time, to the point that rules are made for him that don't apply to others. If you notice, when he does the Sunday morning talk shows, he always calls in. And that's not allowed for, I'm not aware of any other candidate that is allowed to do that. And if you call in and you're not on camera, you could have other people basically helping you with props, with notes. You could be reading instead of, just answering the questions. So he's getting treated differently. And it's a ratings thing. I mean, he's willing to say whatever he has to say to get himself airtime. And it's called earned media. And frankly, when you fact check anything he says, up to and including that he's the one paying for his race, he's put almost no money into this. Most of it has frankly been from earned media and earned airtime from news sources. But he's been having fundraisers. He gets caught having a fundraiser. You see the things that he still says, no, that's not really me. I'm not raising money. I can't be bought. And so at some point, the entertainment value of Donald Trump goes away. I have a feeling when we come out of the holidays, Trump will not be as high as he is. But he does have a very dedicated part of the base vote that sees him as the only person being really tough on immigration. And meanwhile, Donald Trump is playing to any bit of xenophobia that he can to keep a spot carved out, whereas the rest of the pack, as it dwindles, Donald Trump, I think, is at his high point. He will not get over the 25-28%, depending on what poll that you read, for anything. But when you divide the rest of the vote between, I don't remember what we're down to now, 12, 13 candidates, it makes it a lot harder for anyone to break through. But I have a feeling after Iowa, or even going into Iowa, you're going to see a lot of these other candidates drop out. And really what you want to be looking at is how many people really stay affixed to Ben Carson. The Trump voter and the Carson voter, and to some extent a Fiorina voter, are really a Ted Cruz voter. Almost everybody else, if you look at them as part of the old line establishment, one experience wing of the party, probably right now looking like they're coming behind Rubio. I just don't see Jeb Bush having another trick up his sleeve to get people to take a fresh look at him when there's so many other candidates that people haven't taken that look at yet. And so unless there's real oppo out there that will damage Rubio's campaign, I'm kind of seeing it coming down to Rubio versus someone out of the Carson Cruz wing of the party. And Trump is almost a total third wheel, if you will, that's drawing in I don't even think an average Trump voter is a what I would call a traditional Republican voter. If you look at the stances that Trump has had, most of them are not compatible with Republican voting strength. And so most people, even my own good friends, aren't still really sure where a Trump voter or what a Trump voter is. And more importantly, because he's not really putting, his entire effort is a media-driven one. There's very little on-the-ground organization, even though he has some state coordinators named. How much of that translates into Iowa? Trump's going to do horrible in Iowa. New Hampshire, not really a Trump state either. When you go to the Super Tuesday SEC primary, mostly southern states after that, Trump could do okay, because there it's as much about name ID on a big playing field as it is about your organization. But I still think we're oversampling Trump voters at this point. He's truly a force. I'm not saying he's not, but I just really don't think that showing up in the polls shows up at the ballot box.
Yeah. Well, that was great analysis on that top line. And, of course, there's so many folds within this primary. And, of course, then you can extrapolate over to the other side. Catherine, go ahead and take this national discussion anywhere you want to.
Okay. Hey, Charlie.
Hello,
I want
Catherine.
You to know I had to come all the way to my true blue hometown of Ann Arbor, Michigan, in order to bolster my ability to talk to you tonight.
Well, whatever it takes, but I can't remember how Michigan did yesterday, but I think they kicked out a win. So.
I don't pay any attention to football.
Of course
anyway.
You don't, you socialist.
So I have been really surprised by all of your analysis. I do think I know who the Trump voters are. I think they're people who don't always vote. I think they're people who are disaffected by politics, but they're intrigued because he seems to be so different than other politicians. I'm not convinced that that's true, but I think that's the way, sort of one of the memes he's trying to, you know, pass off. But the thing that I think has surprised me the most is Jeb Bush. And I mean, I don't think you and I have talked about this, but I think a lot of us on the Democratic side sort of thought that he was going to be the, you know, sort of the, you know, the
establishment choice.
Establishment choice, and pretty much was just going to sort of march through. And I'm just wondering what you think. I mean, is this, like, do you think this is a Trump-Carson thing, or is it Jeb?
It's a little bit of both. Every election is unique and different and forward-looking, and yet the only real way most of us have to try to explain them is to look back and look for parallels.
Yeah.
If you want to look back and try to put taking the Trump scenario out of it, because I still just don't believe, I don't know how much of it is real, part of it is, but if you want to go to Jeb's issues and problems, I would say let's go all the way back in the Wayback Machine to 1996 or even early in 95. When Phil Graham out of Texas was the couldn't-be-beat establishment choice of the GOP, and he actually, at the time, he had raised $20 million for his primary, which was an unheard-of number, and he made the quote when being asked about it, well, money is the mother's milk of politics. And Graham, if I recall, didn't even make it to, definitely not through, New Hampshire, because he was out of the race when it came out of New Hampshire and came to Super Tuesday next, of which Georgia was a part of, the first main primary that I worked in, where we nominated Bob Dole. So much for that. Dole at least got the nomination, but he didn't go any further against a strong Bill Clinton. What you have with Jeb Bush is the what you would generally call the moneyed establishment, often referred to as the smart money. And smart money likes to bet early because that way they can be on the winning side and thus have the year and whatever. And frankly, they bet wrong this time. I'm not saying Jeb's totally out of it, but his name is synonymous with a Republican Party that looks backwards. I'm sorry.
It looks like he's out to me.
Oh, I mean, for practical purposes, he is, and yet with so many people in the race, and it's still a few months, but you know, my general philosophy is people tend to lock in the holidays. So the polls aren't really going to change a lot from whatever we get this week to wherever we are on Christmas Day, barring just some major news on one of the candidates. Your average voter will pay attention to the holidays, will not pay as much attention to this. But when we, you know, spring out of Christmas and New Year's, then we're roughly, 4 or 5 weeks away from Iowa. And then people get serious. But I have a feeling you're going to see the polls change a lot over the first 2 weeks of January, because that's when people are going to get serious about who are they going to vote for, where news media organizations quit looking as much at national polls as they are now, which are completely meaningless because we don't have a national primary. You'll start looking at polls in Iowa, and Trump's not going to do well in Iowa. He just doesn't have the organization, and frankly, he's not a social conservative. On the Republican side, Iowa is a very social conservative state. It's the kind of place where Rick Santorum has won before, and you know, that propelled him to absolutely nothing in the last presidential cycle. And Trump doesn't do well when he's not first. His ego doesn't take well to that. And so depending on who he lashes out at and how, I have a feeling that will handicap in New Hampshire. And when he doesn't come in first, and maybe not first or second in New Hampshire, then you've got an equally interesting thing of, okay, the guy that's been using his I'm first in the polls, I'm first in the polls, if he goes through those first two and isn't first, does he continue on with it? And I'm not sure that he does, because I still don't know why the man's running. I don't think he honestly believes he's going to be president. I think he's there to be subversive, and or he just thought this would be a great thing for his brand that he values at $3 billion. But by the time it's done, I don't really know who's going to want to do business with the guy. And so with the kind of campaign that he's running and the position he's taking. So that all said, you know, getting back to Jeb, I just think you've got a Republican Party that would rather look forward and try to figure out what's next rather than looking, you know, the name Bush, the first, both good men, but I don't think that most Republicans feel like that we really want to put another Bush on the ballot, especially if you guys are going to go with a Clinton. I mean, another Bush Clinton race, really? It might be time to look at different names. And the electorate is kind of saying that with the sheer frustration on both sides at both parties' establishment. I think Republicans are wising up to that and starting to look at other choices, such as, you know, Cruz, Rubio are probably the two that most people are going to look at.
Okay, thanks. I think, am I sending it to Tim now, David?
That
Tim, one. Be right.
Yeah, Tim's
hey,
ready.
Tim.
Good evening, sir. How are you getting along?
Well, with a little medication, we're doing just great. How about yourself?
A little medication, huh? Yeah. Well, if
oh,
I
yeah.
was better, I would. Well, I'd be better, wouldn't I? But anyway, I've been in politics longer than I care to remember now, Charlie, and I've learned some basic things. Number one, you never go out on a blind date with somebody named Big Ethel. You never play cards with a guy named Doc, right? Whatever your problem is, it's not the alcohol's fault. That's another locked in stone thing. And the fourth thing is, no one is unbeatable. There's no such thing. But in the state of Georgia, health issues aside, is Johnny Isakson as close to unbeatable as anyone?
I would think so. I've written a column almost to that effect. I guess to start at that point, I'm not aware that you guys still have come up with a name, unless I'm just forgetting, but I know we thought Ralph Warnock for a while was going to be the challenger, and he's taken a pass on the race.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny's got a couple of Republican primary challengers in name only. I would be surprised if either of them actually get to qualifying, but I guess somebody will put up $4,000 or $5,000 for one of them to qualify, but they're not what I would call serious challengers. And then the Libertarians have announced who their candidate's going to be, and, you know, the Libertarian will get the normal 3% of the vote unless you guys just somehow don't put up a candidate, at which point the Libertarian will get 25% to 30% of the vote. But, I mean, Isakson, throughout his career, has done things what I would call right. He's still one of the guys that makes no apologies for trying to cut deals in Washington to get things done. He will work across the aisle. And so I think a lot of Democrats are aware of that. And while
mm-hmm.
ultimately I expect you guys to nominate somebody, I just don't, you know, when you get to a general election, there's a lot of folks that some might be on this line with me, but that will possibly never admit it. They're going to vote for the guy because he's got a good record of trying to do what's right for Georgia. And I just don't see, you know, he's his style of politics is something that's rare but refreshing. He does things, he does kind of go to the beat of his own drum, but it's usually through a fairly logical path. But, you know, he's a guy that wants to work on serious problems and serious solutions. He's not Mr. Soundbite that says whatever the flavor of the day is. I know myself when I talk to him, but I frankly know a lot of folks that are, shall we say, much more center-leaning to left of center, that know when they sit down and ask them a question, they at least get a straight answer, not just, you know, somebody that pulls out political talking point A, B, or C, depending on the closest they have to what the question they were just asked. And so, short answer, and you say health issues aside, I don't see that he's announced he has Parkinson's, for those that are possibly
mm-hmm.
outside of Georgia but not familiar with it. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's, Kyle Wingfield of the AJC made the comment when I forgot what public appearance we were at, but we were both listening to him answer questions. And Kyle tweeted out, for those that are thinking Johnny has slowed down because of his health issues, he's still talking faster than we can type. And he is. he's as sharp as he's ever been. He will admit that he physically moves a little slower than he used to, but he's still the Johnny that I've known since I first met when I was on the campus of the University of Georgia back in the late 80s. And he's a guy
right.
that wants to get stuff done, and, you know, he's still up there working every day. And ultimately, I just don't see what the calculus is to putting a team together, either in a Republican primary or a general election, that sends him home from Washington. I think he's got a good 6 more years in him. He thinks he's got it, and he's going to run for it, and he's going to work every day like he is behind, which is what always gets him elected well ahead.
Hmm. All right, then. That was excellent analysis as well. Before I turn it back to David, I want to turn it to another elected GOP official in the state. you know, there's been much said in recent days about these voter disks that have gotten out there with a lot of personal information on them from like 6.1 million registered voters. And, of course, Secretary of State Kemp is probably going to take a lot of heat. Where do you see this going, Charlie, or is it going to be a big issue?
I think it's more of an issue of what's next for the Secretary of State. He's had his name out there unofficially. He was one of the ones looking at a governor's race and has been positioning himself for that for quite a while. And when you look at the long history of just general snafus, specifically in the IT side of that office, it goes mm-hmm. to questions of management, and he's going to have a tough time answering some of those. Just on this particular thing, this was not let known to the public until someone sued him. It's not the first time that it's happened. And even the story of what's happened with these disks still, frankly, has a few holes in it. So there are still as many questions as there are answers. And while it might not, shall we say, permanently damage him while he's in the Secretary of State's office, it might, if this grows any legs between either the lawsuit and or the open question still on has the data really been shared or have the disks been destroyed with all original data with it, it could be a longer-term problem, especially when you start tying in some of the other IT issues this office has had since he took over.
Uh-huh. Now you made allusion to him being one of the people that might wish to advance his career in the future. Are you saying that this could be a huge issue with Republican primary voters when they're looking at him, or
and or donors? I mean, going back to the Jeb Bush analysis, you know, to run statewide, mm-hmm. you've got to have people willing to write the checks to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's looking like he's not as good of an investment, if you will, because of this, that could change whether he decides to sit still in the Secretary of State's office, possibly gets a credible primary challenge in that office, or if he, you know, can raise the funds to move up. And if he was someone that was planning to move up to either governor, or some rumors have him at lieutenant governor, this, again, depending on how many legs it gets and how quickly he can get it out of the press, might have some bearing on that early fundraising, because frankly, the race for governor is going to start right at a year from now in public mm-hmm. official. It's already, you know, behind the scenes, people have been positioning for quite a while. But as soon as we clear the presidential election in 2016, everyone in the state of Georgia will start looking at statewide, because we have a term-limited governor. And thus, you know, more than likely, Casey Cagle will take a run at governor. And, you know, he, by all means, should be declared right now the front runner. At least in speculation. He clearly has not said anything publicly about running for it, but I have no reason to believe he's not. And so, you know, then you've got lieutenant governor open, and it starts, all those statewide offices are wide open, and thus we have a two-year election cycle now. And so the public part of it starts a year from now, and that starts generally with people that are already going to people during this time saying, if I do this, are you going to raise money for me? Are you going to back me? Are you going to endorse me? And if this story continues out and or ties into some past issues with that office, it just makes it a lot harder for people that want to put their name on the line there.
All right. Thank you, sir. David?
Well, Tim, it's like you knew where I was going. I was going to ask about this voter file controversy with voters' information getting out. Now, Charlie, I got some follow-up questions. You mentioned that other ambitious Republicans may be looking now at Brian Kemp because he's got this stain. Do you think it's more likely that a Republican tries to take him out and is successful in the primary, B, he survives because he's the incumbent, but then Democrats are able to defeat him in a general election, or C, neither one of those scenarios hurt him and he can continue to be Secretary of State reelected?
Ooh, I don't think so.
Almost too early to tell. I could draw out any of those scenarios of how they would probably work, but you know, we really almost have to get through this this legislative cycle and the election before it's 3 years is just such a long time in terms of all of those possibilities of what could happen. We'll be very interested to watch what happens in this year's primaries and who is tied to whom when you go with that. But let's just be honest. It's very hard to run against an incumbent in a down-ballot race. This issue would have to be shown to have affected individuals and or huge payouts by that office and damages to the state of Georgia to really get legs in the media. But I've tried to raise money for Secretary of State's races before and other down-ballot statewide races. The attention span of your average voter, it's hard enough, frankly, to get people to concentrate on state offices beyond governor or maybe U.S. Senate. So when you start getting at races like Secretary of State or Labor Commissioner or some of those other ones that are way down or not even that far down the ballot, something like this could be a blip 2 years from now when that race is going retail, or it could be, as I said, part of a string of other things. But if you're going to have somebody run and challenge them for Secretary of State, you almost have to have somebody that can self-fund at a rate that would make you wonder, why do they want that office? Not to say those people aren't out there, but to raise real money to take out a sitting person of one party on the primary side is always very difficult. That said, Kemp, has pretty much been known inside Republican circles to be looking up at a different job when this term ends. And, like I say, it appears that both governor and lieutenant governor may be open. I would say that the result, if this has damaging effects, is more likely one of him possibly running for reelection as Secretary of State right now and not passing on the opportunity to move up than anything else. But, it's just a question. We need to wait and see a couple more weeks and see if there's other shoes to drop. And then, of course, we have the benefit of this going into the holidays, and people are just as likely to forget about it if there's not something new to come out.
Yeah, that seems to be the case in a lot of statewide issues inside the state. Everybody's so focused on national politics all the time that a lot of controversies you think used to would stick don't anymore. Well, let me ask you another side of this, not about Brian Kemp, but about the voter data being leaked. And used to, when I first registered for the 90 election, you registered. I'm sure I had to give some kind of identification, but it was not a complicated process to register to vote. And you didn't have to give all kinds of your personal information. And also, when you got your driver's license, you didn't have to show your birth certificate and all these different pieces of information you do now, power bill. And so all this voter and ID and driver's license information's all gotten intertwined now. A lot of this is through the voter ID bill. And do you think there's going to be a backlash among Georgians, not necessarily against the voter ID bill, directly, but people are going to be like, I don't want to give all this data when I go vote or when I get a driver's license, and because, the Secretary of State's office can't secure it, and it become like a de facto way to kill or weaken the voter ID bill?
Well, this is where we outkick my coverage a little bit, but I will say that I don't believe all the information is from a voter ID bill. I think it's from the Real ID Act, which is a federal act, and all states have to be compliant with having a secure ID that is part of a post 9/11 Homeland Security deal, if I'm remembering the genesis of it. But all states by this year had to have a compliant ID that works for along a federal guidelines, or they lose money. And I know going back to Louisiana, at one point over the summer, some of my blogger friends from Louisiana were all posting stories that if they wanted to travel at an airport by the end of the year, they were going to have to take their passports with them, because Louisiana is the one state that is not conformed to the ID standard, and thus a Louisiana driver's license could not be accepted as a viable identification passing through at airports. And so I don't think all the data is part of the Voter ID Act, so much as it's a Homeland Security Act, if I'm remembering right. But in terms of will there be a backlash from the voters over this? No, because it's something that those of us that follow this stuff all the day aren't even sure, based on this conversation, of exactly where it's coming from. And when in doubt, people tend to blame the president for everything. And so will that affect the local Secretary of State's race? No.
I'm going to interrupt here and say what I think it might do is just make people less interested in voting. You know,
and
just
I can
be like,
see that.
Oh, you know, I'm, you know, now they're going to have all my information.
As negative as everything, well, again, if you have a driver's license, that's where this comes from. The Secretary of State doesn't collect
but
this information. This is stuff coming from the driver's license.
I'm not saying it's a legitimate reason to not vote, but I think that's the kind of, like, this is the voter file, and people will say, it's just, that was my first reaction was, oh, great,
I would be willing to bet if we had a way to actually prove the metric that probably less than 2% of Georgians have any idea that this story is going on. This is an inside baseball story for those of us in politics, and those of us that follow politics closely are all aware of it, but... And until someone puts some money behind it in an opposition research style campaign, it's just data that we all know about. But your average, you know, Georgian right now is trying to figure out where the best Black Friday sales are, not who has their data from the Secretary of State.
I also will say that I think this could have been an opportunity for Brian Kemp to be to show some sort of executive power or muscle, and if he had come out very strongly and said, you know, we are swiftly taking care of this. It was a, you know, it's a terrible error on our part. But I don't think I think he could have been.
He did that in writing, but the problem is that the written thing changed about 3 times over 36 hours, and so that's usually not best for strong statements, shall we say.
Right. I mean, I think he could have come out. This could have been not. I mean, I tend to agree with you. I think people are going to ignore it, but I think it was an opportunity that he missed to be very forthright and sound very executive. But I don't think he took advantage of that. He for whatever reason.
Well, you know, sometimes those cameras, they can be scary. So I'll just leave that to any comment that his office wants on it, but. At the end of the day, this is one for inside baseball for now. For the inside baseball players, I think it has implications for the future, but you know, it's just one more flaw in the armor.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Catherine, I think you were next anyway on questions, and so we still had some more Georgia topics, including this possible impact of the Religious Freedom Bill and probably some other things we hadn't even gotten to. So you choose, Catherine, and then pass it to Tim.
Okay, well, might as well talk about the Religious Freedom. It's probably going to come back up in the legislative session. And there's, you know, been a number of stories over the past couple of weeks about potential, you know, I guess the latest is some college sports tournament possibly moving away from Georgia or not signing up to be in Georgia because of it. What do you think is, and I know you're pretty well connected, what do you think is the upshot of all this talk?
I think it's going to remain a lot of talk with a lot of hyperbole on all sides of the issue. As far as actual legislation that will pass this year, I have a feeling you'll see something akin to what's come out of the House, which is the Texan Act, that will pretty much say that churches are absolutely off limits for government to go in and tell a pastor what they can or cannot preach or what ceremonies they will or won't perform, that the government will stay out of that. There's almost no resistance to that on the left or, you know, groups that are opposed to RFRA because they're like, well, that's not what we're trying to do. If there is opposition to that, it will be from the pro-RFRA backers that see it as a way of taking their issue away from them and watering it down to the point they're not getting what they want. So they may try to hold that hostage, which would probably please a lot of people just fine.
Well, I just want to ask you a question. Is there laws now that would make it possible for the government to come in and say to a pastor?
I think you're looking at the fear that some people are interpreting the law that way. Specifically, I believe it's being fed not from Georgia, but what from the mayor of Houston has done, where basically they requested, you know, and again, I don't know how much of this is, I've not investigated, but I've seen reports of, may or may not be true, so I don't want to vouch for them to be clear on that, but the mayor of Houston has taken a very aggressive approach to what can and cannot go on in the churches of Houston up to asking for copies of sermons to try to determine if they were going to be compliant or something like that. And again, I don't think anyone really thinks this is going to happen. It's just a way of asserting that it will not. A lot of what happens in the electorate is based on fear that may or may not be rational, but this is a way to at least tell the voters, no, we're not going to stand for this, which most people would already say is a violation of First Amendment rights and the Establishment of Religion Clause and anything else. But that's been really what a large part of the talk of RFRA has been, is explain to me how a RFRA law is needed, given that there are already protections under the Civil Rights Act, Establishment Clause, and the First Amendment for freedom of speech. And the folks that have wanted RFRA can't usually answer those questions to the satisfaction of the people that have been skeptical of allowing the bill to pass. That at the same time, there is so much pushback and to the point of hyperbole coming from the opponents of RFRA that what we're going to end up with is a war of a lot of people saying a lot of things that frankly have nothing to do with the bill that's being debated. And I cannot see the state passing with governor's signature a bill that will allow what we would call affirmative discrimination, if you will. So I honestly think there'll be a lot of noisy fights and protests over RFRA this year as far as it actually passing in the form that it was proposed last year. I would say less than 50% chance of that.
Okay. I'm gonna bet on that. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead, Tim.
As I said, I would expect if the Pastor Protection Act can get through clean, I would expect something like that to pass, because frankly there's no opposition to it other than people that want to use that to play politics wanting
right.
to pull RFRA bill. But I don't see that RFRA without some form of an affirmative statement that is a non-discriminatory bill included in it would pass. And again, Indiana kind of being the example. There are versions of RFRA that could pass, but it's going to need to have some sort of statement of what it's not allowed to do. And the bill as proposed has absolutely nothing to do with anyone's wedding cake. It's about services on behalf of how the government delivers them have to be blind to religion, or not. If the government's going to intrude on someone's religion, they have to do it through the least intrusive means possible. And then it gets into all legalese. And frankly, as I said, the problem that why it has not passed the last 2 years is that those that were sponsoring it could not give specific examples of how this would affect someone in Georgia that is not currently covered under the legal sections I just mentioned. And until that answer comes, I don't think you're going to have a governor willing to sign the bill, nor a House willing to move the bill to the governor.
Okay, Tim, it's your turn.
All righty. Charlie, I'm not going to ask you the easy question, which would be who's going to win the GOP primary in Georgia. But you're a nuts and bolts guy, a party guy, an organization guy like I am. You go around the state a lot. You talk to a lot of different people. You meet with a lot of groups. Whose presidential campaign organization do you find to be, shall we say, impressive in this state at present?
The two that really have ground troops are Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. They both seem to understand the organizational level. I speak to a lot of meetings, but I haven't. It's not as obvious of the ones I've been going to lately that the presidential campaigns are really in full gear, with the exception of Ted Cruz. People have a pretty good statewide, and frankly, Scott Walker had a good statewide group, and many of those people merged into Ted Cruz's. Rubio's folks are a little, I would say they might not quite have as many, but they've got the group they have is pretty good, and it's getting bigger by the day. And it's not the traditional shows up at the GOP breakfast kind of crowd but it's folks that are influencers and know how to influence their peers through both traditional and non-traditional channels. And those are the two that I see most. And then I'd say third is probably Carly Fiorina, amazingly enough. She's done a pretty good job of organizing the state. And fourth, which is the one that would probably surprise me most of all, but John Kasich actually has a decent group of people organized. Fifth, I would say, is Bush. It's the people that we kind of described earlier. It's more of the folks that write big checks rather than the folks that do the grassroots kind of things. And like we discussed before, money only gets you so far if you don't have ground troops. And I just haven't seen that they've got the organizational folks.
Well,
I probably left out Ben Carson, and you should have Ben Carson in there somewhere. Ben Carson is the guy that wins every internet poll right now, so they've got someone working it. I don't see them necessarily in person at the events I've been to, but his people are at least out there. And then Trump's people are not organized, but I have run into several Trump supporters at the events that I've been to, but there's nobody driving that bus other than the media, if you will.
Well, that was something I was going to ask you about. You know how well Trump has done in the national polls. And I agree with you that his ceiling is 25% to 30%, but still, that's a significant sampling in the polls. And I got this feeling that the grassroots organization does not match that. Am I right?
That would be my take on it, but I will also, he's got the outsider label, and I will go back to point out one of the things that actually does scare me about the Trump organization, even though the candidates are almost nothing alike, their message was very similar. David Perdue did not have the grassroots organization to start with. He built one on his own, you know, he kind of ran as the outsider, and when you went to Republican groups and all of that up to including the runoff with him and Jack Kingston, you just didn't see those people there because they were, I think it was Catherine that said earlier, I look at these people as non-voters. They might be voters, but they're not the people that show up at a Republican breakfast because they've been fed up with it for a long time. And so I still don't know what a Trump voter is exactly, other than someone that's just fed up with everything. I think, you know, that you see that on the Democratic side, and y'all can explain a Bernie Sanders voter to me at some point, because they're also equally angry with everything. I mean, it might be for different reasons, but in the age of social media where there are people that make a lot of money turning people against everything. Everything is awful proud. We've been calling them the purity for profit folks about a couple of years ago, and now I'm calling them the false profit for profits. You know, there are a lot of people that make a lot of money doing nothing but telling you it's awful, keeping you outraged, send me $5 or $10 so we can fight these people. And what Trump has done, if there's a positive side, has exposed a lot of these people that are clearly, you know, there is nothing conservative about Trump's history and many of the stances he's taken, including the stances he's taken now. And if he was anyone else, they would have been destroyed as a candidate. But Trump's people keep telling you have to vote for Trump because of principle. And the people that are making money off that or will not call Trump out on the things that he said is actual record. It really is showing who's in this for, shall we say, other reasons. Many of them are monetary.
All right. Again, excellent analysis. And with that, I'm going to throw it right back to David. David?
All right. Well, Charlie, I'm going to give you a little bit of an answer of my theory on your question about Bernie Sanders, and then I'm going to throw a question back to you for the other side. I think what I'm seeing in politics, I'm seeing in life, I think you see in religion, is this. People want to be the most pure they can possibly be. And they say, man, I'm just a better Democrat than you, therefore I'm going to find the far most left candidate I can, you know. And Bernie Sanders fits that mold more than Hillary Clinton. And so they want to go as far to the left. I think you see this on the right, and that's where Ben Carson and, like, Ted Cruz come in. They're so far to the right. I think we'll do this in churches. Oh, I'm better Christian than you, and I'm going to go as far as I can in some ideological direction. Do you see that on the Republican side, or is this just my criteria?
Oh, absolutely. That's a large part of it, because that's what our messaging has – and, again, I think it works on both sides. I can only speak to the Republican side of it. But our messaging has always been, you know, we've got to be more, the most conservative person wins. And so, you know, you could take almost any issue, and the person that runs farther to the right ultimately is the guy that is telling the people in a room what they want to hear. And now that we've got the internet and we have 500 cable channels and everything else, everyone can pick and choose where they want to get their news from, what facts they choose to use, and they can build their case to affirm what they already believe. Whereas we've gotten to the point that when people hear something they disagree with, they think all of a sudden you're the enemy and you must be destroyed. I mean, it's a very sad day in the country where, I mean, again, you're having me on as a Republican. I take it you guys still are not, despite my best efforts, but you're welcome to come over anytime. But, you know, it's when you are even seen talking to someone across the aisle, even for none of us that are running for anything and don't care to, it's almost looked at by some people as an act of being a traitor. And that people that don't agree with what you believe are bad, horrible people. And that's not what this country is all about. You know, governing is about going and voting and how we're going to, you know, do the things that we need to do that a government is supposed to do. But it's not supposed to be what drives our life and be what, frankly, our underlying belief system is. And, you know, we can't figure out how to get along with our neighbors, then what this country is supposed to be about isn't what it's about anymore, and that's a shame. So, you know, politics is politics, but it ain't life, or it shouldn't be. And for those that it is, they need to get one.
Well, I'm going to ask you another question about candidates. One candidate I don't think we've mentioned tonight is Rand Paul. And if you think about Ron Paul, his father, he had a small but sizable and rabid base of voters in 2008. He built on it in 2012. And I think a lot of the theory was Rand as an establishment more candidate, held a higher office, his Senate, and he would just grow that even more. That hadn't happened at all.
What's happened to Tom's most interesting politician? You look at Rand Paul and you look at Ted Cruz, and they have to absolutely loathe what's going on with both Donald Trump and Ben Carson, because they both set themselves up to run against the traditional GOP establishment. And by the fact they're both sitting in the U.S. Senate and they've had to take votes on issues, they're now, to your average, we hate everything that's establishment voter, they're establishment, and they don't get it. And so it's like, hey, you guys are now part of the problem. And so I was genuinely looking forward to this presidential cycle because of the quality of candidates we had. Y'all may disagree, but in terms of the experience on various points of view of issues, and Republicans haven't really decided what they're for since 1980. We've been trying to kind of warm over a caricature of Reaganism conservatism, and we haven't been doing a good job of it. And you have Rand Paul coming from one corner of the party and Ted Cruz coming from one corner of the party, Governors Walker and Jindal and Christie and Kasich, who have all had very different takes on what they've had to do to govern, and Bush as well on education down in Florida. We could have had a true debate over what is the future of our party and what does conservatism mean, and instead we've gotten the Donald Trump clown show. And so we've been robbed. But to answer your short question, Paul has no traction, and frankly he needs to start worrying about not losing a Senate seat in Kentucky. So I would say he might be out before Jeb, but his days are numbered, and it's time for him to go.
All right. Well, Tim, Catherine, if either one of you, like, it's true, false, or what's the word kind of questions, we might have time. Anything from y'all?
I'm good.
No, I'm good. I'm good, too. I'm not going to say go Tech, Charlie. I know that's a bridge too far for you. But Buzz just laughed.
Well, Charlie, since you write at Peach Pundit, to be fair, and of course you can't give us the long form version of it, but anything new or what's going on at Peach Pundit that readers can look forward to?
We're about to go into the holiday system too, and I encourage our writers and our readers to go get with their family next week. So we're not going to send out our weekly email. And, you know, frankly, it's time to, as I said, politics and life. So this is a good week to go is celebrate life.
Hear, hear. Amen. Well, hopefully folks can listen to this as they're fixed over the holiday. And I'll just tell everybody a little note. Catherine, Tim, and I, we decided we're not going to be on next week. So we'll come on back in December so folks can get a little less political over Thanksgiving. And we'll join you back in that first Sunday Or maybe it'll be the second Sunday. I have to look at my calendar.
No, it's the first.
It's the first Sunday in the CSW. So it'll be the first Sunday in December. But, Charlie, thanks again for being on the Cozy Vine.
Well,
thanks,
happy
Charlie.
Thanksgiving to you all.
Happy Thanksgiving,
Thank
everybody.
Thank you, sir. Good night.
And with that, it's a good evening, and happy Thanksgiving to everyone out there from the Cozy Vine.
Night, y'all.
Good night, guys.